Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the disgusting scandal at Penn State University that has resulted in the firing of the university's president and the famous coach Joe Paterno, which provoked a student demonstration in support of the disgraced football coach. The award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, Will Bunch, joins us to explain the moral vacuum at the university and apparently amongst the student body that allowed the activity of a serial pedophile to be covered up for so long, and why students would demonstrate in support of those who covered up such appalling criminal behavior. Then veteran Texas journalist James Moore, who is writing a book about Rick Perry, joins us to explain the latest public display of political inadequacy from the Texas governor, who could not even remember his own simplistic ideas. We will discuss what Perry's wealthy backers expected from him and why they didn't even bother to find a candidate who could survive the less than rigorous softball questioning at audience-friendly, highly staged presidential television debates. Then finally, science writer Margaret Wertheim joins us in studio to discuss her new book, Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. We will discuss outsider physics and fringe theorists who probe the cosmos in their own way, and since all great truths begin as blasphemies, as Galileo learned the hard way, they might just end up being proven right. Joining us now is Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and a senior fellow at Media Matters. He blogs at Attitude, that's attytood.com. He's the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, Hive Deaf Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. He has a new ebook, October the 1st, 2011, The Battle of the Brooklyn Bridge, which is about the Occupy Wall Street movement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Yeah, Ian, thanks so much for having me back on. I really appreciate it.
And there you are in the middle of Pennsylvania, and the scandal at Penn State is consuming the nation. It's absolutely confounding to think this has gone on for so long. The original incident that was reported took place in 2002, and it apparently was pretty graphic and pretty grim. And how did it take this long for the perpetrator of this to get indicted only a few days ago, and those that covered it up to get fired?
Yeah, well, it's actually even worse than you said, Ian, because actually there was a report that was made even further back in 1998. So we're talking 13 years ago now, and it's very strange. The 1998 allegation was kicked around, and like the campus police of Penn State University knew about this allegation that this assistant coach Jerry Sandusky, who, by the way, I mean, it was not just any assistant. I mean, he was the number two man under Joe Paterno, and was for a long time considered to be his heir apparent until he mysteriously resigned, which I'll get into in a second. But campus police and some other people looked into this 98 allegation that had been reported. I think the mother of the child reported possible sexual abuse, and nothing happened, which is very strange. And a year later in 99, when this coach Sandusky was still pretty young, only like 56, he mysteriously resigned, which makes you think that people from the university forced him out because of this problem that he was having with young boys. And then in spite of that, he was still allowed full access to the campus, full access to the football team's facilities. And it was in those facilities in 2002 that something just remarkably disturbing happened, which is an assistant coach in the Penn State program was in the locker room on a Friday night, and he heard some noises and actually witnessed, according to his testimony, this coach Sandusky performing a sex act on a young boy in the showers at Penn State. And
10-year-old boy, wasn't it?
Yes, right, 10-year-old. There's some uncertainty whether that's the exact age, but that's how he reported it or viewed it as being a 10-year-old boy or somebody of approximately that age. So he... this assistant coach took his concerns to a couple people, but mainly he took them to Joe Paterno, the legendary coach of Penn State, who just recently became the winningest coach in major college history. Again, this was the 2002 incident. So he went to Paterno, and Paterno told his supposed boss, although really Joe Paterno is probably the most powerful person in the whole town, but I mean, he told his nominal boss, the athletic director of Penn State, and other people were filled in. But the bottom line was nothing happened. Nobody went to the police. It's believed that knowledge of this incident went as high up, perhaps, as the president of the university, and nothing was done. And I think, you know, I think the reason nothing was done is because, well, they didn't want to endanger Joe Paterno's legacy. They didn't want to endanger the program. This program is a big moneymaker for Penn State. And really, you know, I mean, Penn State over the years, just in the course of my lifetime, I mean, they've really increasingly defined their identity as a university and as an institution through their football program. And, you know, even though, you know, it's an outstanding academic institution in a number of ways, I mean, they have one of the top meteorology programs in the country. They're very excellent in geology and other fields. But basically, you know, people who go there, I mean, football just becomes how you define yourself. I mean, I think, you know, you asked in your introduction, you know, why these kids went on a rampage and rioted last night. I mean, they're losing Joe Paterno was like having their whole world ripped from out of them, which, I mean, may sound crazy to an outsider, but to these kids, it made perfect sense.
Well, but it certainly doesn't make sense to me, because here in Los Angeles, we had University of California students protesting and occupying the Banks of America's, refusing to leave until their messages to the board of directors was faxed on. I mean, this is that's the kind of activism that we're starting to feel encouraged about that's happening on campuses. What happened at Penn State last night is just appalling. I mean, do they not understand the issues involved here?
No, I don't think so. I think, I think Joe Paterno has just been such a legendary figure on this campus. I mean, just a father figure to people. I mean, I think many of the current undergraduates are people who went to Penn State partly because the whole experience of the football program was. You know, it's just such an integral part of being at Penn State, going to the games and feeling that you're with a winner because Joe Paterno was a winner. And to have this change, I mean, it was just last weekend that he won the game that made him the winningest coach of all time, and he's carried off the field. And
but isn't that what's raising a lot of antennae, that the fact that he just reached that milestone, that important milestone, and a lot of people are speculating is that maybe is an explanation for this extraordinary long cover-up. I mean, how long has it taken this grand jury? I mean, it's gone on forever, hasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, this investigation has gone on for 2 years. I mean, there is a there's an outstanding journalist at the Harrisburg paper, a woman named Sarah Gainan, who's, I believe she's only about 25 years old. I mean, she's a recent Penn State graduate herself, which is why she has a lot of good knowledge about what's going on there. But this reporter has been investigating this case herself for more than 2 years. So, this has been out there. And I think Paterno getting the record as the winningest coach, I mean, that certainly was another motivation. That's probably why he's hung on to his job. I don't know if your listeners know, but Paterno is 84, going on 85. He'll be 85 next month, and he's well past the age that most people would have retired. But he's one of those people who says that he would die if he was no longer coaching, basically. And so there's that. But I just think I just think Joe Paterno became larger than the institution, in the end, he became larger than just common sense and human decency in this case. You know, these were children. There are as many as, let me put it this way, there's a minimum of 8 victims in this case, and I think there's a lot of suspicion that there's more than 8 victims involved. And these children had their, you know, youth and their, you know, a big part of their lives robbed from them. Nobody with this university that people trust their children to for 4 years to be educated, nobody with this university did anything to stop it. It's really very, I mean, people here in Pennsylvania have talked about little else for the last week. I mean, people, And it's funny, I think even here in Pennsylvania, I think the majority of people, I mean, even though Penn State's the largest university, I mean, most people here are not Penn State alum or Penn State grads. And I think even people here in Pennsylvania look at these kids who rioted last night and they're like, what are you doing? You know?
Well, tell me though, Will Bunch, again, Will Bunch is the award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he has a new e-book just out, October the 1st, 2011, The Battle of the Brooklyn Bridge, which is about the Occupy Wall Street movement. There's reports from he's both a columnist for the Beaver County Times and a radio personality, Mark Madden, who supposedly exposed the Penn State child abuse scandal back in April. He's claiming...
There's a lot of, it's kind of unfortunate. This guy's reporting is getting hyped by people like the Drudge Report and also the Huffington Post.
Right.
And I'd have to say at this point, I'm very dubious of this person's reporting. Part of the thing is, this is really a failure of the media, is this actually should have become a big story back in March, because March was when this reporter that I mentioned to you earlier, this Sarah Gainham from the Harrisburg Patriot News, first broke the story that this coach, Sandusky, was being investigated. This guy that you just mentioned, this guy Madden, the column, he didn't break the story at all. He just wrote a column using the facts that had been reported 3 days earlier in the Harrisburg paper. But I think because the fact that the initial report back in March didn't get picked up, it didn't even get picked up in the newspapers here in Philadelphia, which I find, in hindsight, given what a big story this has become, is kind of shocking. It's just the ways of the media world can be mysterious sometimes. And this
Let's hope the Pulitzer people recognize this young woman, because
I'm pushing for that. Actually, I think she's incredible. But yes, this guy, just to address what you're talking about, this guy Madden came out with a report on the radio today saying, that he's heard rumors, basically, that there was Sandusky was part of this broader sex ring, perhaps that people who donated money to this kid's charity that Sandusky had started and which is now believed he used to identify his victims.
The Second Mile Foundation, right?
Yeah, the Second Mile Foundation.
Which finds disadvantaged youths, right?
Right. And so, there's a rumor that investigators are looking at a broader sex operation through this charity. But I just want to stress that it's a very unfounded rumor at this point. It hasn't been confirmed. I know I tried calling the Attorney General's office to see if they would confirm or deny that this is being looked into. And they haven't. They're not even responding at this point, basically.
Let me ask you though, Will Bunch, in the broader context, do you think that this long, long cover up here at Penn State that finally resulted in the firing of this coach and of the university president. Two other people were fired earlier, but it's the idea that it went on for so long is just unbelievable. But is this really a mirror into what is a broader problem with higher education in the country, and as much as being corrupted by big money, big sports, corporate power, all of this stuff the television buys, et cetera. Is that what's going on here?
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny because in the week that this has been a big story here, people have been making the same analogy again and again, which is comparing what's happened with the scandal to what happened in the Catholic Church with their child sex abuse scandal. And I think it's a fair comparison in that what you have here is an institution that thinks that's full of itself, that thinks it's doing good work, and as a result, that good work that they do makes it basically above the law. Penn State and the legacy, which I think increasingly is looking like a myth of Joe Paterno, was so central to Penn State. I mean, this is the donations that they get from wealthy alumni, and so much of this is tied into football as opposed to, like I said, I mean, it's a shame because Penn State actually is an outstanding research university. They do a lot of good academic stuff, particularly in a lot of scientific fields. And, you know, your listeners probably don't know that, but they know about Joe Paterno and Penn State's football program. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you, though,
I think they wanted to preserve this at all costs. And yes, I mean, you see this mentality at other universities. I mean, what's made this special in a bad way is the child sex abuse angle. But I think it's the same attitude you see at major universities across the country.
Well, Will Bunch, just in closing, though, I don't mean to be. I think I've expressed my disappointment in the students, because you've been covering the Occupy Wall Street movement, and there's a feeling that there's a new kind of politicization on campus. That's you know, maybe it's nothing like the '60s, but at least it's a sign that the students who are encumbered by enormous debts with very, very limited job prospects are realizing they're being ripped off by the system and want to change it. And I mentioned the demonstrations out here at University of California, Los Angeles, against Bank of America, etc., while these students are rioting in support of a guy that covered up really disgraceful and heinous crimes. Apparently the students are using the word being sandusked. I mean, is that true?
Yeah, I read that today. In fact, there was I think it was the Sarah Gainham again, but the Harrisburg paper did an interview with a relative, a sister of one of the victims of Sandusky, who happens to be a student at Penn State. And, you know, this sister is mortified that kids are talking like that. And, you know, I mean, it just goes to show that, you know, like the old Robert Palmer song says, it takes every kind of people, you know, I mean, I think what the people are doing at some of the California universities, and you know, I just posted on my blog last night the video of what I would consider a police riot against peaceful protesting students up at Berkeley. It was just outrageous, and you are seeing a new spirit of activism among young people, and I think that's because they. You know, realized the setup they're getting into with, you know, ridiculous student debt, with the lack of job prospects, et cetera. And so you see that, and you even see that, you know, there are even people at Penn State who are, you know, with this movement. But, you know, you also have a group that, it's hard to explain.
Yeah, well,
you know, you have this group that sees life as a football program.
We have fight on here with USC. I thank you for joining us.
No, well. I know. College football is big in Los Angeles, too. But, I mean, this is like an existential thing. This is like their identity, you know, their identity as Penn Staters, which is their identity as people, comes through the football program.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Will Bunch.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ian.
Great. I was just speaking then with Will Bunch, who is an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He blogs at attitude.com. That's attitywtood.com. He's the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy, and The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. He has a new ebook just out, October the 1st, 2011, The Battle of the Brooklyn Bridge, which is about the Occupy Wall Street movement. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Texas governor, Rick Perry, with somebody who really knows him well, Jim Moore.
Poor boy. Head against a pillow, fast asleep. Poor girl, head against a window, lost in dream. But one day they will be as giants, stronger than the sun. But that day ain't yet come. Always walking you down memory lane. These things I say, I seem to have been, but not half as much as I'd like to intend. Cause listen to you reminds me of a motor's endless drone, and how the deaf are so.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Moore, who's the author of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power, Bush's War for Re-Election, and he's the co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and the author of Bush's War for Re-Election. An Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent, he has traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976, and he's writing a new book on Texas Governor Rick Perry. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Moore.
Always good to be with you, Ian.
And Jim, do you think that now that you're doing a book on Perry, is this 53-second brain freeze the final chapter?
I think what's appropriate is the title of the book, which is Adios Mofo, which is one of Perry's comments that he made to a reporter when he got tired of answering questions. I think what will happen with Perry is that he won't quit right away. I think the thing that you have to consider is that he has never been able to embarrass himself, and he isn't self-aware enough to understand that he looks horrible and that he should go away. And he is, you know, he's one of these guys who thinks, well, I'll try something, I'll do it until I fail, and I'll try again. So he's not going away anytime soon. And remember, he had more money than anybody else. He had $13 million. So he has $13 million left. He had $15 million. And it comes down to a question of what his money people and his advisors will tell him, look, Governor, it's hopeless. Don't do this to yourself. But it's not at that state yet. And I think he's probably going to stay around at least through Iowa to see what happens. And I suspect he'll hang around at least through South Carolina if he can raise money. But what I'm hearing today from people close to the campaign, that raising money is becoming an issue.
So far, though, the money he's raised from the people that are backing him, my understanding is that's what Big Oil and a lot of his local backers. Give us a description of who it is that thought this guy could be president of the United States.
Well, it's a bet that corporate America is making, Ian. And these guys, the Fortune 500s, all the multinationals, have been coming to Texas and doing whatever they want under Perry. They walk in, and it's almost a quid pro quo. It's, you know, people call it cronyism, but I felt all along that it's absolute corruption. Instead of being elected, the guy should be indicted. He basically says, okay, what's the deal? What do you want to do? And then, you know, he ends up with a nice campaign donation, which is what we saw in the HPV case. And so those are the people who are betting on him because they love the idea of a Rick Perry in the White House where all they have to do is pick up the phone and say, you know, hey, Governor, let's get rid of all the EPA regulations, or maybe let's turn FEMA into KBR Halliburton FEMA and sell naming rights to federal agencies and basically privatize everything that exists in America. Those are the people that are betting on him. And a lot of those corporations, especially the energy industry, are headquartered here in Texas. So whether they will back off from that bet, I don't know. But I don't think it's going to happen just that quickly.
Well, I guess, Jim Moore, the point I was trying to make is that this is an example of corporate cynicism and the extent to which business titans look down upon politicians as mere hirelings. That is endemic. But I guess in this case, the point is that they didn't even bother to get a guy that could even pass muster and get elected on the unlimited amounts of money they were prepared to pour his way. That's
But he had done so well in Texas, Ian.
He had been
their yard man in Texas for so long. They thought, well, geez, let's go ahead and see how this plays on the national stage. And I think that's where it fell apart, because he never had to debate here. He never really had to be accountable for anything. He ran off to the right edge of the political cracker, and the voters followed him. And, you know, he had enough support to get elected. But you know, he would not have gotten elected in the 2006 campaign if the Democrats had got their act together and had not divided the vote three ways. He only got 39% of the total.
So it's not a case of his backers not doing their due diligence then?
No, I think that they love this guy. I think the cynicism you describe is astute as all get out. But I think that they love him because he is simply their manservant. He is a guy who will do as the multinational corporations want, and they know it. We have great experience with it down here. I mean, here's a guy who allows his own state to have one out of four people without health insurance, and we have the highest number of people over age 25 without a high school diploma. We have the most uninsured children in America, and he doesn't confront those issues, and yet he creates a $500 million corporate fund to lure businesses to Texas and writes these checks. And people like, you know, Washington Mutual came down here, Countrywide came down here, all of these, you know, HP, they came down here and they promised, give us $20 million and we'll create 3,000 jobs. Well, they come down here and they create 50 jobs, and they don't have to pay it back, you know. And those are the things that he is interested in, and he's not interested in the human issues that are a central part of government.
Again, I'm speaking with James Moore, the author of a number of bestsellers and also Texas-based Emmy Award-winning television and news correspondent who's traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976. He's writing a new book on Texas Governor Rick Perry, who in the Republican debate, the most recent one, had a 53-second brain freeze where he was simply unable to remember his own simplistic ideas. I mean, that's the part of it I find extraordinary. It's not as if his platform is particularly complicated.
No, he frankly doesn't. I don't think has a platform beyond, you know, the sort of GOP conservative archetype, which is let's remove regulations for business, let's cut taxes for business, and let's get out of the way and let business run the world and we'll all be better off. He hasn't had any more complex political thinking than that, and he hasn't needed it in Texas, frankly. He keeps getting away with things down here that are just, in most states, would be beyond comprehension. As I said a little bit earlier, I think it transcends cronyism, and it's actual corruption. It's a cash and carry government. It's pay for play. And you know, he just recently cut $4 billion from the state budget that cost us 100,000 approximate professional educators, schools to close, and we have horrible test scores down in this state. And none of this seems to be of concern for him, and he's yet to pay a political price.
Well, Jim Moore, if he would have answered the question right, he said there were three agencies he was going to cut: commerce, education, and he couldn't think of the third. And he was prompted by Romney, who said EPA, and then he said, no, that's not it. And apparently the answer he was looking for was the Department of Energy. Well, had he remembered that, of course, that's an absurd notion, even for a conservative, because they're the custodians of the nuclear weapons, you know. Would he be able to answer the question, oh, you want to get rid of the nuclear arsenal too?
Yeah, well, you know, it's beyond an absurd notion, but he views it just as he does the Department of Education as creating regulations that get in the way. You know, he talks about better schools being run locally, and then, you know, we in Texas, our kids are tested so many times that most estimates are now they spend 80% of the year preparing for or taking tests in public schools, and they're not learning anything other than how to pass tests. And this is something that he has pushed upon the Texas taxpayer. And oddly enough, you know, one of his big political supporters and a guy who is on his staff at the same time he's lobbying for this company called Pearson Publishing, they have a contract which is worth $500 million a year with the state of Texas to administer these tests. These are the kinds of things that, you know, they pass for yawning politics down here, and Rick Perry gets away with it.
Well, it's an extension of what Bush tried to do. After all, he was the architect of Leave No Child Behind. Isn't it a part of this notion of privatizing anything that's public and turning schools into businesses?
The thing I find astonishing about it, though, Ian, is that How can you, out of one side of your political mouth, talk about less regulation and less involvement in making government as inconsequential as possible in your life, and then turn around and say, oh, by the way, the state is going to administer these $500 million worth of tests to our kids every year to measure them, and the kids are learning how to take tests, but they aren't learning how to think, they aren't learning how to read, and we never call these guys out. In particular, Perry never gets called out on these obvious contradictions. And I again, I'll go back to what I said earlier. I think a part of that is that the public's disconnected. The public is, the level of cynicism that the public has is approaching that of what the corporate guys are, who view the Rick Perrys of the world as hirelings. I think that the process has broken down, and our democracy is bordering on dysfunctional. And if nothing has demonstrated that, it's the quality of the Republican presidential candidates, or the lack of quality, that are even being considered for this job. I mean, Mitt Romney has been all over the map on various issues. He's more politically craven than even John McCain was in the last election. And Newt Gingrich, and the list of people that are on that stage that have almost no qualifications to be president of the United States ought to frighten the American people. But they apparently are not paying close enough attention.
Well, obviously, Rick Perry's cronies got a $500 million contract there. That's his MO in terms of the people who administer these tests. And I entirely agree with you about the absolutely astounding ignorance that's displayed, and also some of the most blatant prejudice, and particularly from Herman Cain. I mean, he said some really outrageous things that nobody checks him out. And the debate that they just had, they clearly all agreed not to even mention Herman Cain's problems. But there was one question from the CNBC reporter about these growing number of sexual harassment charges being leveled at Herman Cain. The audience booed the reporter, and then they cheered Cain for his non-answer.
I think it's kind of strange that, and I was, you know, when we had spoken previously, I've been thinking about this a bit, and I begin to wonder if everybody talks about the new kind of economy we're dealing with, where we're going to live with 10% approximate unemployment forever and ever, and we have to all make do with less, and the markets are not responding to, you know, investment and debt and loss and credit and interest rates anymore. The markets are disconnected, and everybody talks about a new economy. I think that what may be associated with that is a new kind of politics where you can do these things and not suffer. It's perhaps a politics of alignment, maybe, that if you are aligned with a particular group and a particular type of thinking, people suggest that you're their candidate, and there's not much that can be done to knock their judgment off. And because if we were still in a sort of political reality where your morality and your record mattered, Herman Cain would be history, and Rick Perry wouldn't even have gotten this far. And yet, Cain's numbers, while they've taken a hit, we haven't seen him be completely destroyed, which would have happened, I think, is you know, as far back as 2000, and certainly 96 or in the Clinton era. So and something new has happened that I don't think we've quite figured it out yet, Ian.
Well, Jim Moore, you mentioned morality. That, I think, is what's astounding about what's happening. And our previous guest, of course, was talking about the Paterno case at Penn State. It feels like the entire country's adrift without a moral compass, that it doesn't matter. Morality and ethics don't matter. That is, I think, you know, I can understand everybody does reality shopping and they want their reality reinforced. But what about this measure of human civilization, morality?
Well, it used to be important in politics, but the human nature of people who were our public representatives who spoke for us was often hidden from us. And, you know, everybody cites John Kennedy as the most obvious example. But then one day Gary Hart said, "Follow me around," and reporters did, and they discovered that he was not who he said he was. And it launched a complete new dynamic in terms of journalism. And what we end up discovering more and more is that not only are the people that we choose to lead us not any different than us, in most cases, they are considerably less than us. And if that's the way the people we have chosen to lead the country are acting, and that's their moral status, then what does it say, as you suggest, about the rest of us? And everything from Penn State to an immoral war to, you know, the way we spend our tax dollars, we seem to not know who we are anymore. I think the people of the United States used to know who we are and what we stood for, and now we all wonder. We all look at what's happening in our communities. We look at what's happening on the national level and in our politics and our government, and we basically see institutions in what looks like an almost constant state of decline, and we either feel very frustrated trying to do something about it, or we throw up our hands and suggest, I'm just one guy, and my vote obviously doesn't count because I've been voting for 40 years, and nothing has changed, and it's only getting worse, and we cave in, just like the people who are leading us, and I think that things continue to fall apart. How we turn this around, I wish I knew, because then I would run for public office.
Well, just in closing, Jim Moore, back to Perry, there was another meltdown before this where he appeared to be drunk in a speech he gave recently in New Hampshire. And his handlers came out and said, no, he wasn't drunk. And he rambled on. A number of people, Rachel Maddow and others, had some fun with it. You know this guy. You've known him for years. Does he? We know about DWI, right? This is a case of what? Campaigning, CWI, campaigning under the CUI.
I know that Rick drinks, and I know of, you know, there's an incident that's detailed in the new book about, you know, when he got to Austin and he'd been here a couple of years, he'd been asked to carry a piece of legislation. He agreed to it, but he often said, don't bother me with details because I'm not going to pay any attention anyway. Just tell me when and where to show up. And he would start hanging out at the Austin Club where the lobbyists were, and they'd buy him drinks and dinner. And, you know, here's this poor dirt farmer kid from West Texas, and he no longer has to worry about the tab. And, you know, he liked to party, and he showed up one night drunk to a committee hearing where a bill that his name was on was to be heard. So it's not impossible. And he has also, you know, he's had these back problems, and I think he's been taking pain pills, and he's over campaigning, and it's entirely possible in the plane into New Hampshire that night, you know, he may have taken a pain pill and had a cold beer or a sip of wine or some sort of adult beverage, and he got on stage and made a fool of himself. And it's entirely possible that he decided that he was being overmanaged and was just going to let fly. But I've seen him speak many, many, many times, and he's never been animated in that way. And his reaction to getting a bottle of maple syrup was beyond ridiculous. So there was something going on, whether it was him deciding to be different, to consciously make an effort to be different, or whether you know, whether he was under some sort of influence, there was something going on that was different than anything I'd ever seen before out of him.
But that's not the same as what happened at the latest Republican debate, because no way in the world a candidate would have got tipsy before such a major event. He simply just is who he is. He's just not up to the task.
He is not, as we say down here, packing the gear. And I think that Rick is, you know, as I said, he's early in his career, and he simply was not interested in legislation. If people had a bill, whether it was a farmers union or whomever, they would go to him and say, here's what this bill will do. And he would say, okay, I'll put my name on it. And they would go out, write up the bill, and bring it back, tell him when the committee hearing was, and he wouldn't even read his briefing papers. He would have them sit there and tell them what they wanted him to say, and then they would go away, and he'd show up at the committee hearing or have somebody call him on when he needed to be there, and he would go in and do his bit and leave. He's very much like Bush in that, you know, he's a dilettante. He's not interested in the details. He's a minimalist, and he's been able to get away with it up until now.
Well, James Moore, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with James Moore, who's the author of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power, Bush's War for Re-election, and he's co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. He's also the author of Bush's War for Re-election, is an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent who's traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976 and is writing a new book on Texas Governor Rick Perry. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be joined in the studio by science writer Margaret Wertheim. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Margaret Wertheim, a science writer who has written for The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, The Guardian, and Wired. She's the author of Pythagoras' Trousers, A History of the Relationship Between Physics and Religion, and The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A History of Space from Dante to the Internet. In her work pioneering new methods of science communication, she founded the nonprofit Institute for Figuring, through which she's created the Hyperbolic Crochet Coral Reef Project, which is now the largest participatory art science project in the world. Her latest book is Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margaret Wertheim.
It's an honor to be here.
And as I mentioned in the opening, you're being drawn to these outsider physicists, these fringe theorists who probe the cosmos in their own way. And since all great truths begin as blasphemy, as Galileo learned the hard way, they might just end up being proven right. What are the chances?
Well, I suppose that depends what you mean by the word right.
I see. But isn't science exact?
Well, that's what a lot of people think the criteria for judging scientific theories is, and in many ways it is. I mean, there's no question that the exactitude of physics has given us microchips because we know about the quantum understanding of matter. Electromagnetism has given us, electricity running to our homes. So there's this huge instrumental part of science which relies on exactitude and very, very precise understanding of things. But there's another part of science, which is really what my book is about, and it's what I call the cosmological function of science. As one great chaos theorist put it, part of the function of science is to help us to feel at home in the universe. And so partly what my book is about is who gets to feel at home in the universe that contemporary theoretical physics describes. So if you look at, our contemporary cosmological understanding of the world is in terms of general relativity and quantum mechanics. But those theories are incredibly difficult to understand. They're couched in this very arcane language, very, very highly developed mathematics, which almost nobody can understand. And so the people that I write about in my book, what I call outsider theorists or fringe physicists, they reject this really kind of academic mathematical understanding of the universe, and their claim, whatever we think of it, but their claim is that nature speaks a language that the ordinary person can and should be able to understand.
So does that mean then that observation experimentation is out? I mean, that's how it's lasted forever. I mean, it's funny that you should write this book at a very moment where in the political world, on the right wing, there's a jihad against science by the fundamentalists and by the Koch brothers and others against climate science. Mm. And in a curious way, on the left, here at this radio station, there's a lot of sort of new age health and spirituality stuff that justifies itself by attacking science and by attacking modern medicine. So you've got the Koch brothers attacking science in order to sell their oil. And you've got the new ages attacking science to sell snake oil.
Mm.
So here you come along and open the door for them.
Yes. I mean, it's very interesting that the book has appeared in this moment. And for all the reasons that you've just said, Ian, I mean, I kind of feel a bit flabbergasted myself, because I first started, as it were, thinking about this book 18 years ago when I met the man who's the hero of my book, a guy called Jim Carter, who has this complete alternative theory of the universe that he's actually now been working on for 50 years, and he has a complete alternative to general relativity and quantum mechanics and the creation of the universe, and this is all dreamed up in his backyard in Enumclaw, Washington, and where he makes giant smoke rings to test his theories. And I'd like to sort of start off by saying, I don't believe that Jim or any of the outsider physicists that I've ever met are going to win the Nobel Prize, nor do I believe that they're ever going to be taught in Harvard or Princeton or Stanford, and nor do I think they should be. What I'm interested in here is two things, is the sociological phenomena of why are these people doing it? At a moment in history when there's so much amazing speculative physics coming out of universities, things like hyperspace theory and string theory. Brian Greene's, you know, new series on string theories is airing on Nova at the moment. Why is anyone in a trailer park feeling moved to have his own theory of the universe, to rebuild physics from the ground up for himself? I've been thinking about this subject for almost 20 years. And it's funny that the book's just come out at this moment when there is, as it were, so much on as you say, both the right and the left, as it were, resistance to science. My book comes from a love of science. I'm a science writer. I've devoted my life to trying to make physics accessible to the general public. So I became completely fascinated. What do these people tell us about our society's relationship to physics?
And this extraordinary fellow whose work is so beautiful. I mean, you're going to be exhibiting it soon, right, in a gallery, because it looks extraordinary just in the pictures that you have in the book. He starts out as an abalone diver on Catalina Island, right? And then he's a gold miner first, and then an abalone diver. That's why I was playing the heart.
Yes, I've been the Neil Young song. Yeah,
a miner for a heart of gold.
Beautiful. Yes.
So tell me about this man's journey towards an alternative theory of the universe. We're not saying he's qualified. I mean, but Michael Faraday wasn't qualified neither.
Jim is a theoretical physicist. That's what he claims to be. And he comes at it from, he spent his life doing things. First of all, he was a gold miner in his early 20s, and then he became an abalone diver out on Catalina Island. And then he actually invented, he made an actual engineering invention. He invented something called lift bags, which is a very simple invention. You use Archimedes' principle. If you want to lift something from under the sea, you can take a bag under the water, inflate it with air, and presto, it lifts the boat up. And he was the first person to actually have these on the market. And so he's now got a successful little company making these things that lift sunken boats all over the world. And while he's been doing this, he's been developing his own theory of physics. And what's driven him is the belief that the universe is like a machine. And he, who's a great mechanic, he's a great natural mechanic, that because he feels like he can fix and repair any machine, he feels like he can, as it were, understand the cosmic machine. And he wants to feel at home in the universe, and he loves science and believes in it and believes it is the right language to describe the ultimate nature of reality. But he believes and insists the ultimate nature of reality should be available and accessible and satisfying to him. So like basically most insider physicists, he believes that science is the language of truth and of reality. And one of the things that I find fascinating about Jim and these other outsider physicists like him is that they, unlike creationists, they actually believe science is the ultimate language, but they resist, as it were, what they feel is the elitism of academic science. And the aim of my book is not to, as it were, endorse that principle, but to actually ask the sociological question, why is this going on? And one of the things, reasons why I personally think it matters that we discuss this is because I think that we do have a lot of resistance to science in our society in a very negative way. But I think part of it is because there is a way in which science has become quite alienating to many people. And I think it's not clear what we do about that, but I think it's a social issue that we really need to look at. How can we, in some sense, make people how can we get people to see the value and beauty of science and not feel that is destructive in some sense to their necessary psychic structures? Mm.
Well, I think in many ways what happened to science, at least in the modern age, is that, as Niels Bohr said, you know, there are no secrets in nature, only mysteries. But then he was grabbed from Denmark during World War II and sent to the Manhattan Project, and that was a massive secret undertaking. And I've spent an awful lot of time with some of the great physicists, Hans Bethe and Edward Teller, and their entire... the great moments in their lives are the most classified secrets of all. There was just a report yesterday about the Iranians' efforts to get a bomb. So, how much has secrecy made it esoteric, and how much have we drifted from Bohr's idea that there aren't any secrets? to nature, just mysteries.
Well, I mean, I think that's a beautiful comment of Bohr's, and Michael Faraday made a wonderful comment, which is quite famous. He said, "Nothing is too wonderful to be true." I think the problem at the moment, sociologically, as I see it, is not so much the secrecy issue, because usually the secrecy things are around scientific theories that might have military applications like atomic energy. But I think the real issue is what the people in my book are really reacting against is what they feel that the fundamental description of reality that we have, is which is being articulated through theories that are ever more mathematically arcane, like the mathematics of string theory, for instance, is just really incomprehensible to almost everybody. I mean, even most physicists can't understand string theory, if the truth be told. Most physicists will openly admit that to you. So if this is the fundamental nature of reality, the question is, should the fundamental nature of reality be accessible to ordinary people? And it introduces what I call the cosmological problem. What happens to a society if its official picture of reality becomes literally incomprehensible to its citizens?
Maybe that explains what's happening then.
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening.
Why people retreat into religion and into false certainties.
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly what's happening is for a lot of people, they try to read books like string theory books or A Brief History of Time, and they can't understand it. So they think science isn't for me, I'm either too dumb, I don't have that kind of a brain, or they think, as my people do, I don't accept that. I just don't accept that I can't understand nature. I do believe that nature is a comprehensible system. And what's happened, and I make this analogy in my book, and it's something that many of my subjects sort of have touched on, is that basically what they're claiming is something similar to what happened in the Reformation. Mm-hmm. You know, Martin Luther made the claim that all people should be able to read the Bible, the Book of God, in the vernacular language, and have a dialogue with God for themselves. It shouldn't be mediated through a Latin-speaking Catholic priesthood. So that was one of the great innovations of the Reformation, to say everyone can read the Book of God and, as it were, commune with God themselves. Now, the similar claim is effectively being made by these outsider theorists, these physics guys, that everybody should be able to read the Book of Nature for themselves and have a direct relationship with nature. It shouldn't have to be mediated through, as it were, an elite priesthood speaking this elite language, i.e. mathematics. Now, I don't see it as my job to adjudicate that claim. What I'm interested in is that the claim is being made, because I'm interested in the ways that science fits into the wider social and cultural landscape of our society. And I think that physics, which is, in theory, the way that we articulate reality, it is facing a problem. Almost nobody can understand string theory or even general relativity.
Mm. But what about Margaret Wertheim again, the author of the new book, Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons and Alternative Theories of Everything. One of the most beloved figures, of course, of science is Albert Einstein. And from my understanding is that he was actually quite accessible. And he wasn't esoteric. Because I remember a quote of his when von Neumann explained game theory to him. Einstein's reply was, God is not mean, God is subtle. So, and he of course has been proven correct, hasn't he? Maybe people couldn't understand his theories, but haven't they been proven correct? So.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Einstein, general relativity has been tested to something like, 20 decimal places. General relativity makes predictions about the warping of space-time that affects light rays, and these corrections have to be taken into consideration when doing calculations on GPS satellites. So part of the reason that we can get GPS so perfectly and accurately is because there are corrections made for both special and general theories of relativity. The Einstein's theories literally work, and I accept them. I have a degree in physics, and I totally accept relativity. I believe in it completely. The people that I write about in my book do not accept it. They completely reject it as a theory of the universe. And it is difficult to understand relativity, particularly general relativity. It's 10-dimensional tensor equations. It is not easy stuff. And I think that is the problem, that people who don't have higher mathematical training feel, I don't understand that part, that description of the universe. I want an understanding of a description of the universe that is available to me. The difficulty, of course, is what do we do about the fact that the instrumentality of science is so successful? The fact that theory of relativity has actually helped to give us functioning GPS satellites. So it's a difficult place. Where do you draw the line about where you're, as it were, going to accept the scientific theories? And where does it grade into something that really is beyond empirical validation, which is where string theory is at the moment.
I understand, but isn't this is one of the things that offends me so much about the global warming deniers. And Rick Perry says it, that these scientists are just coming up with this alarmist stuff to raise funds for their research. And if anybody knows anything about any scientist, I've ever talked to a scientist, they're the most conservative people of all. They don't make rash claims. They're extremely judicious. Isn't that, it's a very, very disciplined, process, surely.
Oh, absolutely.
In other words, so what's this guy doing, blowing smoke rings and planting redwoods in circles? Just to give me an idea in the last minute or so here.
Well, he believes that he has found the true and final theory of the universe because he does really want to feel at home in the natural order. And he believes the natural order is something that he, as an ordinary human being, ought to be able to understand. Whether he's right about that claim or not, I think
we'll
not be able to know right now.
Time will tell. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Margaret Wertheim. Again, I've been speaking with Margaret Wertheim, who's a science writer, and she has written a new book, Physics on the Fringe, Smoke Rings, Circlons, and Alternative Theories of Everything. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.